a reading from the Holy Gospel according to Mark. They came to Capernaum, and on the Sabbath Jesus entered the synagogue and began to teach. The people were spellbound by his teaching, because Jesus taught with an authority that was unlike their religious scholars. Suddenly, a person with an unclean spirit appeared in their synagogue. The spirit shrieked, "What do you want from us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." Jesus rebuked the spirit sharply, "Be quiet, come out of that person." At that, the unclean person convulsed the possessed one violently, and with a loud cry, it came out. All who looked on were amazed. They began to ask one another, "What is this? A new teaching and with such authority? This person even gives orders to unclean spirits, and they obey." Immediately, news of Jesus spread throughout the surrounding region of Galilee. The good news according to Mark.
Praise to you, Lord Jesus Christ.
Anne Marie was very supportive in helping me prepare for this reflection. She loaned me a number of books and she talked with me, but still I struggled doing this, preparing for today. One of the things we're going to talk about is grace and mercy. So if while you're listening to this reflection you say, "She wasn't kidding, she really struggled," remember, grace and mercy. Today's world is a scary place. Earth's record heat streak has lasted an entire year, and there doesn't seem to be a sense of urgency about taking the measures needed to cool down the climate. The hard-fought gains we've won over the years in LGBTQ, rights, women's issues, and racial justice are under attack. We don't seem to be close for the problems of homelessness and hunger, close to a solution for the problems of homelessness and hunger. There is a great partisan divide in this country. One of the sadder things I read recently was remarks that United States Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor made at Harvard. She said, "There are days that I come to my office after an announcement of a case and close my door and cried. There have been those days, and there are likely to be more. There are moments when I'm deeply, deeply sad." This list is not even a complete one of the problems facing us today. In today's gospel, Jesus was teaching in a synagogue when suddenly a person possessed of an unclean spirit appeared and disrupted the teaching by shrieking at Jesus. Jesus sharply rebuked the spirit, and with a loud cry, it came out. All who saw were amazed by the power of Jesus' healing. Some commentators refer to this as a typical exorcism story where a demon is removed from a person believed to be possessed. Today, although we no longer believe our distress is caused by literal demons, we experience figurative demons in the depression, despair, distress, hopelessness, and anger caused by the state of the world. In other words, we all need God's amazing healing. What is the antidote for these feelings of despair, hopelessness, and anger? I suggest three things. First, we can't give up hope. Second is the recognition that yes, we do live in challenging times, but it can be a time of growth if we let it. Practicing mercy and compassion is the third. While we are finding our way through hard and challenging times, it's important that we not lose hope. In the beginning of this reflection, we heard about Justice Sotomayor's sadness about the Supreme Court decisions. But she added, "You have to shed tears, but then wipe them dry and fight some more." Howard Thurman reminds us in today's first reading, read so nicely by Catherine, that the most important battle is fighting against feelings of hopelessness and futility. The real target of evil, he said, is not the destruction of the body or the reduction of cities to rubble. The real target is to corrupt our spirit. He reminds us of the importance of what he calls the little graces. Birds still sing, and the heart is still inspired by the kind word and gracious deed. He tells us that evil cannot be allowed to move into our hearts and overcome us. He writes to drink in the beauty that is within reach, to clothe one's life with simple deeds of kindness. to keep alive a sensitiveness to the movement of the Spirit of God in the quietness of the human heart and in the working of the human mind is a response to evil, to hopelessness. We need to keep hope alive. We're kinder to ourselves if we live in hope rather than despair. What legacy do we want to pass on to those who come after us? Hope for the future or despair? What makes this time so scary is the uncertainty of what the world's future holds. We're worried not just about our own future, but about those of children, grandchildren, and those who follow. But living in difficult and challenging times is not unique to our time period. Many of our parents lived through the Great Depression and World War II. Generations before them lived through world wars, civil wars, pandemic, financial crisis. Challenges and difficulties are a part of every life. No one escapes them. Jesus said, "I have come to let people encounter life in all its fullness." Doesn't life in all its fullness mean all parts of life? Not just the happy, helpful times, but those parts of sorrow, loss, and anxiety. We are grateful for what we call the blessings of life, the good times. But shouldn't we also appreciate the times that lead us to become who we are? Joan Chittister says that hard times are either holy-making or crazy-making. Will we accept them and grow, or will we resist? She writes, "Resistance to the vagaries of life, to those things nothing can control, things like death and loss and rejection, loud neighbors and irritating relatives, only makes them harder to deal with and turns them to acid in our soul." In his book, Finding Meaning in the Second Half of Life, psychologist James Hollis says we may have a fantasy of arriving at a conflict-free plateau or a sunlit glen without struggle. But what he calls swampland visitations of anguish, doubt, despair, misery, and darkness enrich our lives and help us grow into a mature spirituality. "If truth be told," he writes, "we wish we didn't have to grow, but life is asking more of us than that. Life asks us that we live more meaningfully in the face of a struggle." We may consider life a series of peaks and valleys. God is there with us throughout, though we sometimes think it's easier to see God on the peaks. We shouldn't be afraid of the hard things of life. They make us see things differently than we did before. They stretch us and challenge us and make us find parts of ourselves we didn't know existed. Joan Chittister reminds us, hard times teach us what good times can't: compassion, courage, understanding, empathy, patience. Christian writer Anne Lamond says, "God isn't there to take away our suffering and pain, but to fill it with his or her presence." The 13th century poet Rumi echoes these thoughts. "A joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight." We can respond to the world today and to those who think we are responsible for many of its problems with despair and anger, or we can respond with mercy and compassion. The word compassion derives from the Latin and Greek meaning to suffer, undergo, or experience. Compassion means to endure something with another person, to put ourselves in someone else's shoes, to feel her pain as though it were our own. This definition comes from Karen Armstrong's book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. She is a religion historian and writer. She tells us that the principle of compassion lies in all religious, ethical, and spiritual traditions, calling us to treat others as we wish to be treated ourselves. It requires us to remove ourselves from the center of the world and put another there. It requires us to treat everyone, without exception, with absolute justice, equity, and respect. That is the golden rule. She tells us that the golden rule requires that we know ourselves because it is a guide to our behavior with others. If we treat ourselves harshly, that is likely the way we'll treat others. Armstrong says it's useless to castigate ourselves for feeling jealousy, anger, and contempt, as that will only lead to self-hatred. Refuse to identify with them, saying with the Buddha, "This is not mine, this is not who I am." this is not myself. She suggests that we acknowledge our own sorrow and pain and send a message of encouragement and sympathy to our former selves. If we do that, we are able to feel empathy for others. If we have hostile feelings toward others, realize they are suffering in much the same way we are. She says when people attack us, they are probably experiencing similar self-driven anxiety and frustration. They too are in pain. Anne Lamott writes about mercy and grace in a plain spoken style. Today's second reading, which Phil did very stylishly, is from her book, Alleluia Anyway, Rediscovering Mercy. She defines mercy. It means that we no longer constantly judge everybody's large and tiny failures, foolish hearts, dubious convictions, and inevitable bad behavior. And as I read this, I think about how many times I've done just that. We will never do this perfectly, but how do we do it better? How do we help people we've encountered with the understanding of a wise, caring mother who has seen it all, knows that we struggle, know that on the inside we're as vulnerable as a colony of rabbits? And I always think about, it's good to know that other people feel that same way. What I appreciate about her discussions of mercy, and she's said this in a number of her writings, her first thought when she is wounded by another's action is plans for is rage and plans for revenge. But then she pulls back, as in the second reading, when she recalls Jesus' example. She hears Jesus saying that he still loves her despite her initial thoughts of revenge, but maybe she could start practicing forgiveness and inclusion. Lamont says from her experience, anger and self-righteousness are mood-altering. She sees mercy as softening our hearts with a tenderizer of grace, so that if someone has wronged us, we still feel mercifully toward them. She says, bit by bit, you begin to outshine the resentment. You get it. You get that they have suffered. You get what an effort it is for them just to get through the day. Mercy means forgiving ourselves and others. Lamont describes it as our tender-hearted relationship with God, the extreme forgiveness of God, and the wonderfully low standards of God, so that even someone like me is completely adored and welcomed in the great shalom of God wanting us. Nadia Bowles Weber, a Lutheran minister and public theologian, asks about those people who can forgive everyone but themselves. She relates a conversation she had with her sister in which Nadia admitted that she could not let a particular mistake go. Her sister asked if Nadia would extend grace to a friend for the same mistake. Nadia responded, of course, but not to myself. I should know better. The sister responded, well, that's not humility, baby. That's just pride. Refusing to forgive ourselves is saying a polite no thank you to the Spirit's work in us. We may have demons, but they are no match for God's powerful mercy. Your thoughts?